This is WFAE Talks. I'm Greg Collard, news director at WFAE. And joining me, as always, is education reporter Lisa Miller. Hello, Lisa.
Hey, Greg.
Excited for the big alpaca convention this weekend?
You know I'm excited. Yeah. Yep, I will be there.
You really are going to the alpaca convention. Is it a convention? Is that the right thing for it?
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of judging that goes on there as far as alpacas and their fleece. Color, quality of fleece, how densely packed it is, how soft. So may hear more of that Saturday morning.
I'm going to turn your mic on now, Ben.
Yeah, that'd be great. Am I on yet?
You're on now.
All right. Well, that is incredibly rude.
Maybe you talk too much and it's just subliminal message.
That's possible. All right. So I want to hear more about the alpaca convention. What are they doing? What are they judging?
They judge alpacas.
Like what? Do they have a contest? Is there a race?
They have a contest of sorts, and it sounds like there's two kinds of alpacas. There's Wakaya, and they have more of the fluffier fur fleece, and then there's the Surrey, which is more of the dreadlocked fleece. And so they do judge the alpacas on this, and then they have a lot of people who've come with alpaca blankets and socks and scarves and things like that. So I found out that, you know, North Carolina has several alpaca farms, but not nearly as many as Ohio, because like sheep, they like cooler climates.
Hmm. Are they judging them on their fur? Like who has the softest
fleece?
Which has the softest fleece?
I don't know if you break it down that way, but densely packed is one of the things you look for, densely packed fleece.
Huh.
So... yeah, fluffiness maybe.
And we had a little bit of a conversation earlier in the newsroom about would you be able to pet the alpacas?
And that is the one question I didn't ask. I actually had it written down because I do want to do that. There's only one or two baby alpacas, too. So.
Which is a shame because baby alpacas are...
really cute. Yeah.
Well, Ben Bradford, thanks. I'm glad you could join us. We are actually hearing from you now.
Actually, here. Oh, you mean it, like you've turned my mic on?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, I'm glad about that too.
You're not a. You've been reading about the punk rock band Pussy Riot. You're not a big fan of them today.
I have.
That's not true.
Listen. No.
Or is it Cossacks that you're mad at?
So what happened is, well, I am mad at the Cossacks.
Cossacks. I'm sorry.
I am mad at the Cossacks. I woke up this. I've been working for the last couple of days on this. On this story that was going to run nationally on NPR that was sort of a recap of all the different things that have been happening after this coal ash spill up on the border with Virginia. And so I've been kind of scrambling on that. I found out this morning that I've been bumped for the very good reason that band you're talking about, Pussy Riot, which is an activist band in Russia who's been in jail and is now out of jail. They were working on a new video and they were, it's sad. They were, and it's, violent. They were brutally beaten by Cossacks, which are, I guess, this sort of, they have a long history as being kind of marauders. But in this case, I guess they're actually a group now with ties to the government. And they were beaten and horsewhipped by Cossacks in Sochi, Russia, where they were working on a protest video about Putin. So my story is going to air tomorrow. At the same time, obviously it's a very serious and tragic thing.
Sure.
You don't usually hear the words Pussy Riot, horsewhipped, and Cossacks and Sochi all in the same sentence. In that sense, I'm okay with it.
Well, it took a pretty big international story to replace you, though. So you look at it that way.
I appreciate that.
Well, on the story that you were reporting about, we're going to discuss that in a few minutes regarding state regulators and coal ash. They get a little defensive this week. They got a little defensive this week.
Yeah, there's more happening. Not a day goes by that something new doesn't happen, it feels like, in that story.
Well, we'll get to that in about 30 seconds here.
Yes.
All right. A cook at Reed's Fine Foods in Charlotte is rude to Governor McCrory and gets canned as a result. There's been a lot of publicity.
I'm sorry, is that a food pun? Gets canned?
It wasn't intended, but I guess it is. I like it. Lyft, one of the ride-sharing services you access by an app, they are expanding beyond the center city and going out to Charlotte, to Charlotte's airport. And I can't imagine many taxi drivers who are no longer allowed to pick up passengers at the Charlotte airport are too happy about that. So let's get back, go straight back to the top. Ben, environmental regulators, the head of DENR got kind of defensive, I think is fair to say, this week about criticism of his agency. And there's certainly questions over whether the agency is too soft on Duke or too soft on its regulation of coal ash and how it responded to the spill at the Dan River.
Yeah, that's right. So there's been a lot of criticism of this state agency. They are the ones who sort of have the sole responsibility of regulating coal ash because it's not regulated by the EPA. So the way that they do that really is by regulating the water. So coal ash is stored in these ponds that keep the ash wet so it doesn't get dry and blow around and get inhaled, which is bad because it contains arsenic and lead and chromium and a lot of really bad heavy metals to inhale or drink or any of those things. But at the same time, there's this larger context, right, which is these essentially the state is suing Duke over all of its coal ash ponds at all 14 of its North Carolina coal plants. And the reason it's suing them is because the ponds are made out of earth and these earthen dams leak into the groundwater. And the state has had records of the groundwater exceeding federal standards around the coal ash ponds, right? So environmental groups have been upset with state regulators saying that they're not doing a whole lot. But the contention is that the state only started to sue them. It's a little counterintuitive. Mm-hmm. Only started to sue them because the environmental groups were going to sue them, and the state could jump in and under the Clean Water Act that would prevent the environmental groups from suing, and then the state could offer these sort of these settlements that were not that are not particularly punitive.
The state did Duke a big favor by taking its legal action that the governor often points to as proof that the state is not going soft on Duke.
Well, that's the contention from environmental groups. Yeah, they offered a $100,000 fine for the first two, which is Riverbend, which is over here in the Charlotte area, and then Asheville. They offered a $100,000 fine, and then the series of tests by Duke about the condition of the groundwater and how they might address it and all those kind of things. In the test, I mean, I remember adding it up. You're talking at the very bare minimum, if they were to meet every deadline on the first day that they, the earliest that they had to do it, you're talking about, you know, a period of at least a year and some. Mm-hmm. So in reality, you're probably talking about years. And actually, Scavarlo talked about a timeline of about 5 or 6 years to kind of clear this up. And his defense of it, the head of DENR, yes, pardon me. Yeah, John Scavarlo is the secretary of this department. This week, first, there was a committee meeting on Monday. There was this committee meeting. It was the first time that state lawmakers have looked at the issue, and they were hearing from everybody. And Scavarlo, at the very end, offered this very spirit. It wasn't so much a defense as it was sort of an attack of environmental groups. The Southern Environmental Law Center has sort of been the spearhead of this. And then yesterday, there was a press conference, and they offered a very spirited defense. And quite honestly, it's one of those things. It's very tricky to report because on one hand, you have sort of what's happened, right? And we're always interested in reporting what's happened. And what's happened is the environmental groups were going to sue. The state jumped in. You know, it blocks things under this way. There's certain connections between McCrory and Duke and campaign contributions and those kind of things. So you want to get at all that and kind of explain what this controversy is. So the story that I worked on for NPR this week, the one that got pushed back by Pussy Riot, is that there's this other side to it too, which is that there might be a reason that the state didn't act beforehand that's not nefarious and doesn't have to do with them loving, you know, them having this relationship with Duke Energy. Scavarla called it yesterday smoky backroom deals. He was denying that they had any smoky backroom deals or anything like that. And the simple fact for that is that the state isn't really worried about the groundwater seeping into these waterways. And the reason for that is because they're small enough amounts that the state says that when they've tested the water, that everything still meets federal standards for water.
Now there have been studies that says that say this stuff is really bad, though, too.
That's right. That's right. So
are the federal regulate – is the problem the federal regulations? What's
– There's a few things that are happening. Right. Yeah. One of it is that the part of it is that the EPA has not regulated this stuff. So coal ash is one of the largest sources of waste every year that we in the United States generate, just straight up, period. It also appears in all kinds of things. You know, they used it back in my hometown of San Francisco. They, you know, coal ash is in construction materials used to build the Bay Bridge. I think it was the New Bay Bridge. It's one of the bridges out there. I think it was the New Bay Bridge.
Wow.
Yeah, they use it in roads. They use it, so they recycle a lot of it. They recycle a very large amount of it, and they used to, you know, use it as like a top layer, and then it could come off. And there's fears about, there's a lot, all kinds of studies done about how that might not be a good thing. But the fact of the matter is that I think that at this point, it's not exactly settled what the best ways are to be able to recycle this. You know, what it can be used in safely versus what might be harmful. But the fact of the matter is that, you know, if it's safe enough to use in roads and construction materials and those kinds of things, there's, I think, at least I get the sense that there might be a feeling that among, you know, and I'm speculating wildly here, just based off of kind of what I've seen when I've been doing this, that this is not the biggest deal, and it's been kind of overblown. And Scavarlin kind of got at that yesterday in this conference. He said, he talked about that, how the water is safe, but at the same time, these coal ash ponds have these unauthorized leaks. And I mean that word unauthorized very specifically, meaning that the state specifically hasn't authorized them, but they've known about them. What happens is that, you know, coal, again, it's a heavy metal, so it's kind of naturally not water is lighter than it, and the ash sinks to the bottom. And this is the problem over at the Dan River, is that you've got this ash on the bottom, and it could on certain days that ash could get stirred up and then be problems, you know, years down the line. It could be problems for fish. It could be problems for things that live on the bottom of the ocean. And it might not always be a problem. Sometimes you might test the water and the levels come up fine. And as a matter of fact, that's what's happened over at the Dan River, is that we've had days where regulators test the water and the levels seem to have gone down. And then we had that snowstorm, and the snow melts and it all flows into the river, and the river gets higher and gets churned up. And then you see levels get higher again. So the thought is that on these other waterways, the ones that didn't have the spill but have this kind of slow seepage, the same thing could happen. You could have the slow accumulation of these heavy metals on the bottom of the river.
I'm curious if you've seen a different attitude in how Diener is responding since this spill occurred, or even before the spill occurred. Are they responding to you faster? Do they seem more willing to answer questions as the pressure is built on the agency?
Yes, I have noticed a difference. I've noticed that certainly when it comes to their press releases and their reactions to, you know, when they first started reporting water quality tests from the Dan River, the releases sort of downplayed what they were finding in the water. And actually, one of the first releases was wrong. They had found arsenic that exceeded the standard for humans in the river. And then they had to come back and say, oh, wait, no, and they had to report something different. But at a certain point, they started having the same or variation on the same quote in there, which is that, you know, the things that we're testing right now, we're not seeing a huge amount of fish deaths. We're not seeing a huge amount of problems, or, you know, the most of the metals have tested okay, and, you know, the river's not good, but it's tested okay. But we are still very concerned about the long-term health of the river, kind of reemphasizing that.
Now, the Justice Department or the U.S. Attorney's Office has issued more subpoenas.
Right. That's right. And actually, Lisa can tell you a little bit about that, I think. she jumped on that yesterday.
Sure. I went through those subpoenas. So basically, last week, and this only came out this week that they were released, they subpoenaed about 18 employees and a couple former employees of Diener. And basically, they asked for all communications since 2009 between Diener and Duke Energy and Duke Energy affiliates. And the interesting thing, part of this, they said this includes any, you know, items of value that you've received from them, any documentation about it, including stock, including preferential treatment of any kind. You know, hand that over. And so, you know, beforehand, the federal inquiry was just related to the Dan River. And so basically,
It looked at the timeline of the spill. It looked at what was the response, what were the communications between Duke and the state right after the spill happened, and so forth.
So this expanded it to all coal ash plants, onto all of
14
Duke's
coal plants and all the coal ash ponds
across the state. Exactly. And then they also asked for the personnel records of 20 current employees and former employees.
Some of the highlights there were they asked for personnel records for Tom Reeder, who is the head of basically of water for the state agency. And they also asked for the personnel records for a woman named Amy Adams, who is a former state water regulator who quit during the first year, last year, once the McCrory.
Oh, she's in your story.
You know, she is in my story because she quit and then went and joined an environmental group. And she's been very critical. And the reason that she quit is because of changes that have happened at the state agency. And in particular, there's been this change. And Scavarla, Secretary Scavarla has gone on record talking about this, that they've changed sort of their mission statement. And the mission statement, one, is going to focus more on economic development. And two, focuses more on what they call customer service. And they believe that in addition to people and watching out for public safety, in addition to people being the customers, customers are also the businesses and utilities that they work with. And also, we should probably mention, so the U.S. Attorney's Office has not said what it is that they're investigating. So we can look at the documents and see what they're asking for and get a sense of what the investigation surrounds. But the investigation is in relation to a possible felony. And we know that they're looking at ash ponds and at the state's response and all those things. But we don't know that the state agency, that Diener, is the target of the investigation. We just know that they've been subpoenaed for these documents.
And Duke has also said they received similar documents.
Good point.
Well, another story that's received a lot of play across the state and really across the country this week happened right here in Charlotte. Involved Governor Pat McCrory. He was... it's over the weekend at Reed's Fine Foods is that in Myers Park?
It is in Myers Park.
Okay. And a cook went over to help him or ask the governor if he needed any help. And when he asked, when he realized who it was, he said, "Oh, Pat McCrory, thanks for nothing," walked away. The governor complained. He was treated rudely, said, "I'm like any other customer." And just a security detail complained to the owner of Reed's Fine Foods. And the cook was promptly fired. And the cook, by the way, he said he was inappropriate. Be honest, I didn't really see that big a deal with this. And I felt like some of the coverage of this story was like, you know, it was somehow Pat McCrory's fault. I thought that was the tone that I read in the initial coverage, that he was fired after the governor's staff complained. So I was struck by then how this story really just took off. And it's been being used politically as Mayor Cannon is trying to find him a job.
Well, I mean, I can see why it took off. I mean, here you have someone who has a lot of power, the governor, and then you have a cook who probably not making that much and gets fired. So
and according to the story, the governor and his security detail walked over, you know, found the manager, or mm-hmm. found the was the manager or the owner in the parking lot, walked over to him and then complained to him over there. You know, had
what's
to go
wrong
out
with
and
that?
Find this guy. Oh, you know, that's a great question. I mean, I think that Lisa's right when she talks about it as, you know, there's obviously a huge power disparity between someone who's the governor and somebody who's a cook. And I guess, you know, there's also a question of, do you expect retaliation from your governor? I mean, you know, imagine if Chris Christie had done it.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine what the coverage would look like if Chris Christie had done it, right? Retaliation. Now, at the same time, right, absolutely, it's got to be really tough to be the governor and want to go and just shop somewhere. And then you've got somebody calling, you know, telling you off. And, you know, the other part of it is, at least from that story, it mentioned that the governor and his security detail, I think, were saying had a slightly different version of events. It involved mm-hmm. a rude gesture from the.
What does that mean when you say rude? Does that mean flipping them off?
Bird.
I don't ever just say flipping them off. I don't get the whole rude gesture.
Yeah, we're
just
being,
say what it is.
We're being very sanitized. We're being very sanitized. But this is WFAE Talks. It's mildly uncensored.
Yeah, which you know, as you said, was disputed. The cook didn't
right.
say that. But
exactly.
But you know, looking at it, it is. You know, the cook who said, "Hey, they had every right to fire me." I mean, in that situation, yeah, he was rude. I mean, he shared his opinion, but the cook does come off sort of as a bigger man.
Than,
you know,
right.
you know, as sort
right.
of like, yep, I said what was wrong, and I got what was coming to me, and I, you know,
I respect him for having that, admitting he was wrong. But I'm sure the governor, his reaction, I'm guessing here, was a little bit different because it happened in Charlotte and happened, I'm guessing it's a place that he's been to many times over the years.
And I think it's very difficult to be a public employee. I mean, I think more than anything, this is sort of a PR nightmare in terms of how it's happened because of the power disparity mm-hmm. and because of how it looks and those kind of things. But I do think you're right. I mean, I think that it's very difficult to be a public official. These are people don't get into politics, I don't think, for the salary. It's not exactly the best lifestyle. You know, you're shuttling around to all these different places, traveling around all these different places. Your whole life gets just scrutinized, and so you get demonized. And in reality, I think that most public officials get, and obviously there are going to be exceptions, get into it for the public service. They think they can do a good job, and they want to do something.
So why are so many people now coming out trying to help him find a job, though, if he did something inappropriate, and they think, oh, that's a good idea to try to find someone a job who did something he admits he deserved to be fired for?
Well,
and why the public, why so many people are receptive to that?
Well, on the other side, you know, you say, hey, he spoke his mind and he took the consequences of that.
That's admirable.
That's admirable.
I think it's just a political statement.
But you have, it's obviously a political statement when you have Mayor Patrick Cannon saying, hey, I'll help
exactly.
you get a job.
Totally.
I mean, for sure.
You told off someone that we don't agree with, and so now
right.
we're gonna bring you into our fold, and we're going to embrace you.
Of course.
Well, all this being said, I think it's fair to say that the governor has a reputation for being very thin-skinned.
Yeah, I think most of a lot of interactions with reporters, I know, you know, when I've talked to him, especially, you know, after becoming governor, he is very defensive when it comes to questions or feeling like he's been really put upon.
So, you know, I had a background. Before I came out here and before I became a reporter a few years ago, I had a brief stint in politics. I worked on Capitol Hill. I worked for a member of Congress. And she used to say about the press, their only job is to do a job on me. And I think that that is a sentiment that's pretty widely shared. I mean, obviously not everybody, but I think that you can see certainly as a reporter, I think it's easier to see the difference it makes in just how public officials interact with the press. So I think that, you know, I would imagine that if you look at the mentality of you know, we've talked about it a lot, the way that we kind of interact with the administration. And I think that there's a mentality that reporters are attacking them. I think that they feel a little bit defensive. And I think that you see that sometimes.
Sometimes, you know, it's true.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, you think about it, and that's mm-hmm. what reporters, you know, they're picking over everything that you're doing, saying, well, why'd you do this? Why'd you do that? Right? Everyone's a critic. And so I think it's understandable. I think that the effect of it, a lot of times that sort of defensiveness, the effect of it, though, is to actually it just sort of snowballs it creates kind of a vicious cycle, right, where you get defensive, you say something defensive, people criticize you for saying something defensive, and then do it again.
Well, third and final topic for this week's show, Lyft, the ride sharing service you access through an app. These are basically people come and pick you up in their own car and take you wherever you want to go, I guess, within reason. They were in Center City, and now they're expanding to the airport. This struck me as interesting because there was such a big deal made a couple of years ago when the airport decided to restrict the taxi service to three companies. And now Lyft drivers they act like taxis, but I guess they're not. Technically taxis, they're allowed to go there. I can't imagine that the taxi drivers who are no longer allowed to pick up passengers at the airport are very thrilled about this.
I can't imagine that. I mean, I can imagine they're not thrilled at all. You know, you have three companies who are trying to pick up drivers, and then you have a service that is pretty much unregulated and doesn't have to, put credit card machines in their cars, for example. I mean, you know, it is over an app and everything. But yeah, I think it's getting under their skin. But it was interesting. Duncan McFadden,
one of our reporters,
he did a good bit of reporting on that this week. And one of the things that struck me was he talked with Charlotte City Councilman David Howard and, you know, said, hey, you know, you think anything's going to change about this, you know, any regulations? And he said, basically, you know, I think we're not going to get any regulations in there anytime too soon. I mean, what would that would say about a city like that, this, that's trying to be tech savvy? So
yeah, worried about the
image. It's kind of a
that was funny.
Interesting remark. And I'm sure, you know, if I was a cabbie, would definitely feel the double standard very much.
I've never used any of it. Another popular one is Uber. I've never used any of these. Is Lyft the one with the pink mustache?
Lyft is the confused one. If you see, if you don't know what it is, and you see cars driving around with these kind of fluffy pink mustaches, they look like what are those the women sometimes wear? These like kind of fluffy like scarf like things. Right, they kind of look like someone took one of those
scarf like
thing into the shape of an M.
Okay,
right.
So that was like, I think a boa. Are you talking about a boa?
I'm talking about a boa. Yeah, I was about to say that's like the worst description in public.
I only know the boa is a snake. I don't know. I've never heard of that.
Right, so it's like a pink boa okay. then stapled onto the front of a car.
Yeah.
In the shape of an M.
Yeah. And I should go back to Howard. You know, I think the city council is looking at regulations. He wasn't saying that necessarily, but he was saying he was worried about sort of image wise what it would do for the city. Now, I have taken Uber in Chicago. And they are very fast, and they always have really nice cars. It's more expensive
and the way
than
that
a taxi.
Works is that you rate, your driver rates you.
Yeah.
You sign up for Uber.
My driver, by the way, said he was giving me the highest rating.
Right, right. I think that they always say that to encourage you to do the same thing. But,
and tip him.
But then also they rate you, and you rate them, and that way you, I think if they fall below a certain number of stars on their rating, then they're less preferred, or maybe they don't work there anymore, or something along those lines. And on the other end of it, then they can also do the same thing for you. So if you're not a very good passenger, they can kind of filter you out that way. But this is a fight that's happening across the country.
All over.
Yeah. A couple airports, San Francisco, LA, they've cracked down on Lyft and Uber drivers coming.
And one of the big questions is, in terms of accountability, liability, background checks, right? So these companies say that they're doing, you know, vigorous background checks. In San Francisco, I know there was someone who hit some pedestrians. No,
I think it was. I think there was one in San Francisco that was Uber, and the person was not responding to a call. It was an Uber driver.
Right.
They weren't driving anyone, so you
right.
could say
so the
it was
contention
off
from
duty.
The company has exactly. So the contention because these are people in their own cars mm-hmm. who have the app and can turn it on when they want to work. And so the contention from the company was, well, he wasn't our driver at that point. And so it opens up this liability issue that I think just like, you know, just like all these other sort of technology questions that happen, right? We introduce a new technology and then we don't quite know, well, how do we make it so that this can integrate with our society? I think you have sort of the same question there, right? Where our regulations are not built for a company where someone can just, you know, fire up an app and they're temporarily a cab driver.
Okay, guys, well, that's the music. It's time to go. That's why I punched it up.
I see. So, All right. Well, thanks again.
Thank you, and have fun at your alpaca convention this
Cannot
week.
Wait to hear that story.
Can't wait.
Thank you.